Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. I'm Stephen Carter, your, as far as I can tell, still uninfected co-host who has really enjoyed these past 2 weeks, where my natural inclination to deliberately avoid people in public has made me a model citizen instead of a weirdo. Despite its tragic results, the COVID-19 pandemic has continued to lay open some really interesting parts of LDS church culture. The most interesting one, to me, of the past week has been Russell Nelson's call for church members to fast, quote, for relief from the COVID-19 pandemic, unquote. On the one hand, this call isn't anything surprising. The pandemic is a big deal, and Mormons, along with the majority of the religious world, consider fasting a practice that intensifies prayers, gets more attention from God, and brings down more blessings. And this would seem to be a better time than most to have a mass fast. But this call to fast got me thinking about the fasting stories that I've heard over the course of my decades in the church, and I started to notice an interesting pattern. The most productive part of a fast usually isn't during the fast itself, but afterward. Because, you know, in the church we're encouraged to fast for something. For example, for a family member to recover health, or for a testimony of something, or for, as Russell Nelson said, relief from a pandemic. So we take this desired outcome and we build some sacrifice into it. We make it memorable. We throw our bodies off of their normal routines so that the object of our desire is constantly in our minds. And if we do it as a church, then it's constantly on all of our minds. Fasting for something makes that something more than just a passing desire. We're saying that it makes it worthy of God's special attention. But, most importantly, at least to me, it sets an expectation. Now that we've sacrificed for this desire, we're hypersensitive to signs that our sacrifice is being rewarded. How will our loved one recover? How will we gain that testimony? How will we have relief from the pandemic? We're watching now. In other words, what that fast did was open what I'm going to call dramatic space. By fasting for something, we've charged the future with possibility. It's kind of like Chekhov's dramatic rule. If you set a loaded gun on the mantle in the first act of the play, it needs to be shot by the third act. By fasting, basically what we've done is we've set the gun on the mantle, and now we're watching to see when, and most interestingly, how it will go off. So, we fasted and created a dramatic space. And what we have now is a worldwide church whose members are all primed to interpret personal, community, church, and world events in light of the fast. We see something happen that seems to have good results, and we feel justified, even excited, to say, "It was because of our fast. Look at how the Lord has answered us." It infuses events with extra dramatic possibility. Then, I realized that Mormonism is actually full of these dramatic space creators. You know, actions that we take to infuse future events with possibility. Priesthood blessings, for example. I remember a few months before my mission, my dad, who was having very bad migraines, I gave him a blessing. It was a strange blessing, because it didn't promise relief. Instead, it promised that he'd find ways of mitigating the headaches. So what that did was it gave us the latitude to interpret future events as manifestations of that blessing. So later, when he realized that sage smelled like a headache to him and stopped using it in his cooking, we interpreted that as a result of that blessing. Of course, there are also patriarchal blessings, which are much broader in scope. They're meant to make your entire lifetime into a dramatic space. You're expecting things to happen in a particular way. You're primed to interpret your life's events as fulfilling a preset pattern. So it started me thinking that successful religious movements are the ones that are especially adept at creating dramatic space. And Joseph Smith was really good at it. The Book of Mormon, for example, is a masterpiece in this respect. He took the entire American continent and turned it all into dramatic space. Remember when he was leading Zion's camp and they came across those heaps of earth? The Book of Mormon provided the dramatic space for him to interpret them as Lamanite burial mounds, and even to identify and give a story to one of the skeletons. And he didn't just give the physical landscape dramatic potential, he did the same thing to America's future. The Book of Mormon insists on being read as a prophecy of America's future, and we've used it to interpret current events ever since. Of course, you can see the same thing happening in many other parts of the religious world. The Jews have been looking for a Messiah for millennia. Christians have been waiting with bated breath for Jesus' second coming for thousands of years. And that shows how potent dramatic space can be. In fact, it shows something even more interesting. Dramatic space is actually most effective when it hasn't been fulfilled. That suspense, that possibility is what keeps it effective. Has the anticipation of the second coming diminished at all despite 2,000 years of not happening? No, because it's the perfect piece of dramatic space to make meaning out of whatever awful things are happening today. It doesn't matter to us that there have been numerous plagues and wars and apostasies before now that made people certain that the second coming was close at hand. In fact, all of that actually makes us more certain that it's actually going to happen this time. It's like a boulder sitting at the top of a slope, getting bigger and bigger with the passage of time and events. Surely the sheer weight of all the wars and famines and plagues and elections that haven't actually resulted in the second coming will reach critical mass with this event. It may seem strange at first that the power of dramatic space actually relies on not being fulfilled. A prophecy fulfilled is way less powerful than a prophecy to be fulfilled. But as counterintuitive as that is, there's actually something much, much stranger. Namely, the more suffering that suffuses a dramatic space, the more potent it becomes. The worse things get, the more power the dramatic space has. For example, let's go back to Zion's camp. By revelation, Joseph Smith led hundreds of people on a 1,000-mile trek to reclaim stolen property in Jackson County, Missouri. When they got there, 14 people died of cholera, and the group didn't actually even enter Jackson County at all. They didn't reclaim any property. It was a tragic, poorly planned project that burned up already scant resources, and they didn't even achieve their goal. But how is that story told in church? We talk about how it was a proving ground for future leaders. It was the refiner's fire. The suffering and death Zion's camp experienced drove only a few people away. The rest were actually charged by the dramatic space it created. And that dramatic space is still really powerful today. Any Orthodox member of the church will tell you that they thoroughly expect to someday return to Jackson County, Missouri, to redeem Zion. You can see this basic pattern happening over and over again in the history of the church. Bad decisions and tragedies transformed into dramatic space. The Kirtland Safety Society, for example. And, plural marriage. Plural marriage, which was a huge factor in the killing of Joseph Smith. In the forced migration of the Mormons and from Nauvoo, and America's, you know, rejection of Mormonism. Plural marriage was openly embraced in Utah. The more pain that gathered around plural marriage, the tighter they clung to it, until it became evident that the United States would indeed eradicate Mormonism if plural marriage continued. And the dramatic space of plural marriage continues today. I'd say that the vast majority of Orthodox Mormons admire their polygamist ancestors and consider polygamy to be an eternal doctrine. Indeed, official doctrine still envisions a polygamous heaven. So, dramatic space thrives on tragedy, and the more suffering it gathers, the more powerful it becomes. I'm going to play prophet here for a little bit, based on this idea of dramatic space. I'm going to predict that the current president of the United States will be easily re-elected in November, no matter what happens. In fact, I'm going to predict that the worse things get, the better his chances are. I'm going to predict that even if we could officially count how many extra people died from COVID-19 because of his policies, or lack thereof, those bodies will be as good as votes for him. I know, it's a strange thing to say. Shouldn't incompetence on such a mass scale result in a political leader being less likely to be reelected? We'd like to think so, but I think that the dynamics of dramatic space are much more powerful than that, especially when you have a master dramatist at the helm. Though I'm pretty sure that Joseph Smith had a much kinder heart than Donald Trump, they both excel at opening dramatic space. We've already talked a lot about Joseph Smith's abilities, but now let's think about Don. He spent most of his life in the entertainment business, running casinos, resorts, professional wrestling, and reality television. Heck, he spent years as a reality television star. Those decades of experience seeped into his psyche and made him into a finely tuned drama conduit. When he ran for president, he made an implicit promise through his public actions that America apparently couldn't refuse. He promised daily political drama. And boy, did he deliver! He's an overwhelming dramatic force all by himself, as he upends one precedent after another, even though he doesn't know he's doing it. And the dramatic space he creates is so powerful that only one member of the Republican Party was willing to vote to impeach him. But then, COVID-19 came along and stole center stage. But Donald's dramatic genius is in no way failing him. He instinctively knows which way to direct this larger drama. The virus is a hoax. And then, when it isn't, it's being blown out of proportion. And then, when it isn't, he's shutting things down with a firm presidential hand. And then, when people are out of jobs, he's going to open America up by Easter. And then, he suggests that the elderly are willing to die for the economy, so that we can all get back to work. The important thing to see here is that none of these dramatic pieces support any of the other dramatic pieces. They are simply what would be most dramatic right now. And that's what the man's genius is. He doesn't plan these things. He doesn't do them deliberately. He's just a perfect conduit for drama. And he expresses that drama when it's the most dramatic. Why are his approval ratings going up while America has the most confirmed cases of COVID-19? Because he is in the middle of an opening dramatic space. Dramatic space feeds on tragedy, and he happens to be in the middle of it. To the people who support him, and this is a huge portion of the nation, he is a hero simply by proximity. It seems strange that this could really be so, but think about how we tell the story of the Willie and Martin handcart companies. They were the ones, you remember, that set out from winter quarters toward Salt Lake City in August, much later than was usual or safe. And the dangers were apparent, they were known, there was a lot of debate about it, if they would be better off wintering in place rather than taking the risks. According to an article in BYU Studies by Howard A. Christie, quote, "At an open meeting that day, members of the Willy Company debated whether or not to go on so late in the season, and most voted to go. But Levi Savage importantly commented in his journal that after he, quote, warmly, unquote, voiced his objection, quote, "The people, judging from their appearance and after expressions, felt the force of it, but yet the most of them determined to go forward if the authorities say go," unquote. Savage went on to write that on October 15th, another meeting was held, and, quote, "Elders McGaugh, Kimball, Grant, and Van Cott addressed the saints, exhorted them to go forward, regardless of the consequences," unquote. And, to make a long and much-told story short, over 250 people died in the terrible winter storms the companies encountered, and then others died while rescuing the survivors. So, we have a preventable tragedy on our hands. We can see where and when the bad decisions were made. We can see that the people who were part of the process knew that these were at least very questionable decisions. People died because of these decisions. But how does the story get told? Well, here's how an Ensign article introduces it in a 2006 issue. Quote, "This is the story of Latter-day Saints who were motivated by their desire to follow a living prophet and gather to Zion. When they found themselves in the midst of extraordinary circumstances due to a late start and early snowstorms, they displayed courage and faith as they relied on God, the gospel, and one another. No one could have predicted the severity of the snowstorms that created such suffering, nor could anyone have predicted the heights to which Brigham Young, the saints in Utah, the immigrants, and the rescuers would rise in the midst of extreme difficulty," unquote. And then there's the film adaptation of this tragedy called 17 Miracles, and this is the synopsis I found. It says, "As part of the Willy Handcart Company, Levi Savage feared that leaving late in the season would lead to despair and death. What he came to find out is that for every tragedy, there is a multitude of miracles," unquote. So, despite the death toll, despite the avoidability of the tragedy, in the official discourse of the LDS Church, everyone involved in the Willy and Martin Handcart Companies is a hero. And the same thing will happen with Donald, at least within his tribe, which was numerous enough to elect him, and with the help of the dramatic space created by COVID-19, they will probably become even more numerous, just because humans are drawn to dramatic space. But, you know, at this point, I need to acknowledge that dramatic space is quite useful as a cultural tool. Giving people a strong story to interpret events by keeps them optimistic. They're willing to work harder because they believe they're working for something larger than themselves. The LDS Church has learned through trial and error how to deploy dramatic space strategically enough to keep people engaged without spinning too many off into fringe space. You might remember that Ezra Taft Benson spun up a lot of people when he merged politics and religion during his anti-communist and anti-civil rights campaigns, which created a dramatic space that plenty of Mormons are still using to interpret events today. The ruckus he caused inspired the first presidency to send him off to Europe for a few years, hoping he'd cool down. And that taught them to nip these beginnings of extracurricular dramatic space in the bud whenever possible. Their re-recording of Richard Pohlman's talk was one instance of that, and McConkie's public criticism of George W. Pace's book, What It Means to Know Christ, was another. However, if you're high enough in the ranks, you do still have some room to create some of your own dramatic space. Dallin Oaks is certainly creating some that will be with us for years to come, as did Boyd Packer. But I think, for the most part, the brethren understand that the best way to keep the church stable is to keep dramatic space tightly under control, So they talk vaguely of the blessings of keeping this or that commandment, and they put together large programs that keep everybody going in the same direction. And the United States term limits for the White House are probably installed to stop any particular brand of dramatic space from consuming political discourse entirely. To get ready for this episode, I spent a lot of time thinking about how dramatic space works and how it grows larger and more potent with suffering and tragedy, sometimes causing more tragedy in order to become larger. And suddenly a scene from Selma, that biopic about Martin Luther King Jr., came to mind. There's a scene where King is leading a march from Selma to Montgomery. On their first attempt, the marchers are attacked by police officers when they cross the bridge out of Selma, and now they're on their second attempt. The officers are stationed at the edge of the bridge again, but this time they turn aside, as if offering to let them pass. And then King kneels down and prays, and then he stands up and calls the march off. And he leads everybody back to the city. Most of the protesters are, or most of the marchers are protesting. It's a fascinating scene because King resists the pull of dramatic space. The attacks on the first march had already strengthened the dramatic space around the equal rights movement, and especially that march. And if they had been attacked again, I bet the dramatic space probably would have become exponentially more potent. But it's possible that King felt that too much potency would have overwhelmed the movement, turning it into more of a religion than a highly organized political action. So, he resisted the drama. Resisting the drama. I've been chewing on that idea for a few years now. It's always great to find a story that motivates you, or releases you, or makes your world larger, or helps you see things more precisely. But in the end, you'll always find that story's boundaries. You'll always find that there's something outside of them. So sometimes you break through those boundaries, and you're amazed at what you find, but sooner or later you bump up against boundaries again. Most of us spend our entire lives inside of stories. And I've been wondering if there's a way out. A way to be in a story without being of the story. It was actually Terry Pratchett who turned me on to this idea. In his novel, Witches Abroad, he writes, quote, "Stories are a parasitical life form, warping lives in the service only of the story itself. It takes a special kind of person to fight back and become the bicarbonate of history," unquote. The bicarbonate of history. That's an interesting phrase. Dramatic space is a lot like stomach acid creeping up your esophagus, expanding and becoming more corrosive the more you add to it. And yeah, it sounds a lot like what's going on these days. How do you become a bicarbonate of history? Well, Witches Abroad offers an interesting story to illustrate the concept. It's about a fairy godmother who is bent on making sure her godchild achieves a proper happy ending. So, when are we that fairy godmother? When our identity depends on making reality conform to our dramatic space? Well, a good place to start is just to observe your own behavior, and start noticing when you are creating dramatic space, or when you're entering into it. As I said, dramatic space has its uses, so don't feel bad about entering it. Just notice when you are, and watch how it's working. There's a difference between being in a story and being of a story. Being of a story means that your identity is dependent on the dramatic space you're inhabiting. An easy example is politics. I certainly catch myself having knee-jerk reactions to the faces and names of particular politicians, and I realize that my reaction is in great part because of the dramatic space I inhabit. So I've been training myself, with a little success, not a ton, to watch that reaction go by without flaring up. In other words, I try to resist the drama. Frankly, I'm going to have my work cut out for me this weekend. I haven't been able to listen to General Conference for more than a decade without losing my bicarbonate properties. And this weekend, I have to do it, because the Sunstone podcast hosts are getting together on Tuesday to stream an analysis of Conference. And I need to have something to say. Actually, make sure you join us. We'll have John Larson, Lindsay Hansen-Park, Blair Osler, Jackson Washburn, and little old me. It's going to be a ton of fun. Well, that's the end of my spiel for the week. I sure appreciate you listening. And since you haven't seen your bishop for 3 weeks and you haven't set up online tithing payments yet, I am hereby authorized to authorize you to send your back tithing to Sunstone. You'll see blessings shower down upon you if you give at sunstone.org/donate. And this week only, if you double your donation, you'll get quadruple the blessings. Just watch what happens. You'll be amazed. Send me your stories of Sunstone tithing blessings, and I'll share them here on the podcast with a quavering voice and a tear in my eye.